and welcome to Thrift Shop Biography. This is the one about Charlie Chaplin. Thank you for listening. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm dying to talk about Charlie Chaplin.
Me too.
Oh, by the way, listeners, we're talking about Charlie Chaplin this week.
Yes.
His autobiography, written obviously by him. This is an actual autobiography.
That's the first surprise. He wrote an autobiography?
Yeah, and it's huge.
It is, isn't it?
It's expansive and brilliantly written.
It is.
Oh, what did you think of Charlie Chaplin before you read this book?
Ah, that's great, because partly I've always wrestled with him being a fictional character.
Ah.
And like, just somebody you could never meet or talk to, because he's so unreal, because he's from those films that seem so made up and imaginary, don't they? It's just from another time.
Yeah.
And how can that be a real person?
Mm-hmm.
But then I do know, you know, I've been in theatres where you know he's performed, and that's always filled me with awe.
Oh,
like,
wow.
This imaginary Charlie Chaplin actually stood on that stage, Hackney Empire, City Varieties in Leeds. Which is amazing. So I know he's real, and I wanted to find out who the real person was.
Okay.
So I'm really pleased to get the chance to read this.
Mm-hmm. With me, I just knew the tramp persona, really, that image. You know, the
exactly.
Charlie Chaplin that everybody knows with the cane, the hat and the moustache.
Yeah.
In terms of the man, I didn't know anything about him.
No.
I have to say, I don't think I even really knew what he looked like when he wasn't dressed as a
tramp. He's good looking, isn't he?
Very good looking.
He is. I also have to admit, there was rumours knocking around about him and child brides.
Yeah, I mean, those rumours are there for a reason.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
We'll talk about it as a crop up.
I formed somewhat of a conspiracy theory about the whole thing, though.
Have you? Mm. Are you allowed to say that now, or when we get to the part in the book? Should we talk about his beginnings first?
Yes.
Yes. Charlie Chaplin was born.
He was. A long time ago.
A long time ago, like in black and white.
He was born in black and white era.
In 1889.
Hang on, he was born pretty much before black and white, because they didn't even have film then.
Yeah, right.
Or did they?
Photography.
That photography. He was born in black and white and sepia tones.
In South London. Oh, hello.
Yeah.
I didn't know he was British.
Whoa. I knew that. That's amazing you didn't know that, because a lot of people make that mistake.
Yeah. He's such an icon of American cinema.
Yes, he is.
I just totally assumed he was American.
Yeah, why wouldn't
and it
you?
Was, yeah, I had no idea
wow.
about that. So I'm literally reading this book from somebody who just knows the image of the tramp, and
oh, wow.
that's it.
Did you love reading this book?
I loved it.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Loved every page of it.
Yeah.
Gems.
We've been really lucky about finding some really great books.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got to come to an end.
Andrew Ridgely aside. Well, we're interested in people's lives anyway, aren't we?
Yeah. But people write their lives in different ways.
Yeah.
Some of them are boring and some of them are beautiful. And we've read some absolutely great, fantastic books. So, little Charlie Chaplin is born in South London, and he's got his mum and his dad, but he's got an older brother.
Yeah.
And his dad leaves quite early, right?
And
so it's just his mum and him and his brother.
Yeah. And they're across the river from Big Ben Parliament, which is, just to give you a place, because I was Googling it loads, it's just amazing. One of the houses he grew up in is still exactly there. And you know that it'll be a whole posh family.
Yeah, right.
Well-off family, you know, the whole house, not just a flat. To think of how poor they were, to then know how rich you'd have to be to live in that house now.
Yeah, right. I mean, they were seriously poor, right?
Well, actually, at first, for the first 5 years of his life, they weren't, because his dad was a vaudeville star.
Okay.
And actually was on £40 a week.
Ah,
all right. In 1889, it's a fortune. The sheet music of his songs, you know, songs that they'd sell, the sheet music, didn't they, with him on it. And his mum was a star as well, and she was on £25 a week. They had a good start.
Yeah.
A really good start. But then the strange thing was, they'd met in the vaudeville shows, his parents, and they'd gone out with each other for a bit. And then she'd got swept away by some bloke who'd taken her off to South Africa. I think he was a businessman. This is that thing where it's such a fine line in old-fashioned music hall of actor, prostitute. It's just such a fine line. It's like there's no society guiding you at all. You're absolutely free. There's just no social boundaries at all.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be married. You don't. They live as free as we do now within those circles, don't they? So she got whisked off to South Africa, had a kid, had Charlie Chaplin's older brother, over there with this man, had a Sydney. Nice life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then it comes up later that it's possible she was prostituted out while over there.
Oh, my and goodness.
And that's probably where she caught syphilis, because they diagnosed years later
that
her
mad.
Later insanity was probably syphilis from
right.
that period.
Okay.
And then she came back, got back together with Charles Chaplin Sr. They lived together for a bit and had Charlie.
Right, okay.
And then split up when they were... When he was one, at that point, he stopped paying maintenance.
Charlie's dad was an alcoholic, right?
Yeah.
And a bit of a wayward spirit. So he left and he actually shacked up with another woman and had another family, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, they obviously all were wayward because she buggered right. off as well.
But Charles, little Charlie Chaplin and his brother Sydney, who's like 4 years older, are living with their mum, the three of them on their own. And now they're kind of in poverty, right? Because the mum's mental health is not great.
No, but she loses her voice when he was five. So right. He had a taste of an all right life. They had cakes and they had nice times.
And also there's that bit where she's failing on stage.
Yeah,
she pulls off
voice.
And little Charlie Chaplin kind of runs on stage in front of the audience. And kind of wins the audience yeah. over.
Kind just... of does an impression of his mum singing. Which...
That's right. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's his first taste of being on stage
yeah.
at five.
But it is like an isolated experience. He then doesn't do it for a few more years. But he does at like the age of five just go on and the audience love him.
But his mum never gets her voice back. That's the beginning of their real poverty because her income is dried up.
Yeah, so that actually leads to the mum actually having to come to the realisation that they need help. So she goes into the workhouse and then she sends her sons, Charlie and Sydney, into the children's home, right? Or the children's workhouse at that point, wasn't it? So that's a real low point in his history.
Yeah.
But they are in there for a while.
So, I mean, it's real poverty. It's as low as you can get for those times.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'd say without living on the streets, but there's a lot of times... Where she ends up in an asylum and the dad takes them in with
his wife and
other kid who's not even almost worth mentioning. But then this woman's a cow. Well, the father's drunk anyway. He died at 37. And it says that you can't avoid being an alcoholic in the vaudeville circuit because you're expected to go to the bar after a show and drink with the punters.
It's like the Edinburgh Festival.
Is it? It's like the Oldham Coliseum back in the day.
Right.
The actors at the end of the show announced, please come to the bar, we'll all be in there if you all want a drink. She seemed so old-fashioned to me then. This is 20 years ago. That's obviously what they did.
Yeah.
So you ended up an alcoholic, dead at 37. It's nuts.
But his wife... Okay, but then you can't think of it from her point of view. She's married this guy, has a child. She doesn't want his other children turning up and living in her house.
No.
I kind of get it.
I do too. But what a cow. Because they're only kids.
Yeah.
And she'd often lock them out.
Yeah.
And so they would literally were on the streets all night. There's just weird descriptions of them trying to sleep places or gather around fires or go into the pubs.
Yes.
And maybe they'd run into their dad in one of the pubs.
They were real like street urchins,
really feral.
But their mum did go in and out of the asylums, and there was a point where she wasn't so bad and she was out and they went back to live with her in a flat above this other woman. And I think the mum used to do a bit of dressmaking and stuff.
Yeah, a bit
of
sewing.
Yeah, and so would make a little bit of money. Then she'd make a lot of money. Then she'd make none again. But her mental health was shot.
You really get the sense of the day-to-day survival, don't you?
Yeah.
She'd get one
hand
penny.
To mouth.
And they'd go and spend that penny on two
a crust
potatoes.
Of bread,
or And then the next day, how are we going to get through this day?
Yeah, it's proper Victorian poverty.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. It's not half as depressing to read as some of the other people's lives.
I loved reading about it. It was almost like a little Dickensian. Because it's beautifully written as well. It was like a little story. And because it's so different to everything else we've read recently.
Yeah, he's got a kind of nostalgia about it. Because years later, when he's massively, epically famous... He sneaks out and takes a taxi and goes to all those same places.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very nostalgic. Not good times. I don't think they were as deeply depressing to him.
I think that's because his mum kind of hid it to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And I think when you're 5 and 6 and running about the streets and fully independent with your big brother, it probably is. You don't get how the world works. But, you know, he is going and hanging out in theatres and stuff occasionally. It's probably a bit of fun.
Actually, he is. He does go to see all the shows. He's seen all the greats.
But there is a time when he's a little bit older when he's 14. So Sidney, his brother, has gone off. Is it with the Marines?
He's a bugle player.
That's right. He's summoning to the whole crew on these massive ships. Yeah. It's dinner time. But he gets ill, right? And they dump him in South Africa.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so the brother,
and
Sidney.
And there's no way of contacting him, so she thinks he's dead.
Wow.
And that sends her mad. That's another spell in the asylum.
Okay.
Well, they also say that when they went to take her away, because she was absolutely gibbering, she was malnourished.
Right.
So that was her actual first problem. Mm-hmm. But she always made sure there was enough food for her kids. Yeah. She really did her best. And then sometimes they'd get a windfall. Like, I think he found a wallet or something somewhere.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they get a windfall. Well, what would they do? Go for tea and cakes and stuff. They weren't very good with money. She wasn't.
And I mean, if I had a windfall, I'd go for tea and cakes.
Yeah.
But the thing, when now Sidney is away on the boat, sadly, he's got ill, so they've dumped him in, I think it's South Africa.
Yeah.
Charlie, at the age of 14, is looking after his very unstable mother. Yeah. And then she seriously, they come to take her away.
Yeah, and he has to then hide the fact that he's on his own.
He's on his own, because he's 14. He's 14.
Oh, he's 14.
And the landlady who lives below them in this flat kind of says to him, look, I know what's going on. I can't keep quiet about this forever.
Yeah.
Again, he's avoiding going home. Because he doesn't want her turn him over to the authorities. So he's a 14-year-old,
He's not going to school anymore as well.
Not going to school.
And he's hiding, hanging out with these builders. And they're feeding him fish and they take him to the theatre and he's sort of one of the lads. It's really good, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is like a Dickens.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's one of the places he goes to visit as well, to see where the builders used to be. So that's how nostalgic that is to him. That's how much he loved being in their company.
God, he really is on his own, isn't he?
Yeah.
Like a kid running around those Victorian streets just looking for a crust of bread or a penny or something.
Because there's that point where, it's when his dad dies and he wears a black armband and realises he's getting a lot of attention. So he goes to the pub selling flowers.
Right,
and they go, oh, who is it? And he goes, my father.
Yeah.
Yeah, his father had actually died.
Yeah.
And he makes some really good money until his mum says, don't do that. And then he doesn't.
Right.
See, if that was Alan Sugar,
she didn't want the shame of it.
He'd have carried on.
Alan Sugar would have done it before his dad even died.
Yeah. They're not great on money-making schemes, are they, between them?
No.
Until they start to get involved in showbiz. Because his first job, he joined the 8 Lancashire Lads.
The clock dancing troupe.
And you know what? He wasn't 14 then. This is before then.
So
9 or 10 or
right,
something.
Right, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. They were clog dancers, and he got board, lodging, and pay. That was a good job for a while.
I love that there's a clog dancing troupe doing the rounds.
Yeah, I mean, I do. And they weren't from Lancashire, were they? I don't know why they go like that. But this story I love. This bloke who ran it was called Mr. Jackson, and his wife had died, and he needed a woman to help him run this troupe.
Mm-hmm.
So he put, this is like a modern dating app. He put an advert in the newspaper for a wife and he described who he was and that he ran this troupe. He got 300 letters.
Wow.
So it's just like an app, dating app, isn't it? And he thought, I can't deal with this. So he prayed to God, please help me pick the right one. And picked one letter and opened one letter and married that woman.
Wow.
And she was brilliant.
Amazing.
She took on the kids and they were a lovely couple forever.
That's a lesson, really, to modern people on Tinder.
Yeah.
Instead of swiping through 300 people, just pick one.
And go for
leap of faith. Go for it. It will turn out to be the perfect person.
Yeah.
not a catfish at all.
Yeah.
I mean, even then,
it's
100
amazing,
years ago, I think it's still pretty lucky that he managed to pick the one.
But 300 women wanted to marry someone who had 8 lads in
a clog
troupe.
A clog dancing troupe. Hey, maybe I should put that in my next advert. I own a clog dancing troupe.
Anyway, so then they did 2 or 3 shows a night. Okay, reading about the music hall at that time is so interesting because they organised it. So you had all these different acts and then the acts would get on buses. Well, they were like horse-drawn buses in those days and move around the music halls, of which there were so many. Like every borough and every part of London had a music hall in it. So many of them are gone now. Most of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's different times, completely in terms of entertainment. And they would do their bit. They'd obviously had schedules, so they'd be due on 6 o'clock to do the clog dancing thing. They'd be at 7 o'clock at, Clapham and 8 o'clock at, and they'd have to do their thing, come out, get on the bus, and all the troops were being shipped around, and there's a photo in the book of, they all lived in the same area. So you've got this whole photo of all these vaudeville acts and performers around Kennington Road, the old Kennington Road, and about five different horse-drawn buses all ready to take them out for the evening to distribute them around the musicals. Mm. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Netflix killed all of that.
Killed it. Before that, TV killed it.
Yeah,
that's what,
exactly. Yeah. Well, cinema might have done it even before.
Cinema killed the TV star. Yeah. Hang on.
Cinema killed the clog dancing star.
That's right. But anyway, when Sydney came back, and he said, look, our mum's away. We've got to get work. We've got to fend for ourselves. Yeah. And he goes to a theatrical agency.
Yes.
And says, because obviously he's had some experience, says, all right, I'm up for hire. I'm 14. Do you want me? And they went, yes. It doesn't even seem like he had to audition.
Yeah.
They said, yes, we want you in this part. It's a 40-week tour. We'll book you for that. In the meantime, there's this other show and you'll be great for a boy in that.
Yeah. I think, you know, it is quite a matter of fact when that happens. But I think this is, talking of nepotism and stuff, okay, his mum and dad aren't around to physically introduce him to people. But again, it's just that thing that his mum and dad were in that field. Could and as a young boy, he saw them. He knows it's possible. So while they're reaching around looking for jobs and ways to make money, it's just very natural for them to think, well, let's see if there's any jobs in the theatre.
Yeah, true. It's a job. They know it to be a job that can earn you good money.
Yeah.
And also, his mother's told him all his life these stories, constantly telling him about these actors and these characters, and they sit and look at the characters in the street and make up stories, and she's also acting to him all the time.
Yes, yes.
And he's seen his dad, he's in awe of his dad, who was still acting when he was a kid. So that's the way to make money and have an interesting life.
And also at that point where Charlie Chaplin is going into a theatrical agent and saying, oh, hey, got any jobs? And they look at him and say, yeah, we do. Also, he doesn't have the complications of having a parent who might then go in and say, well, you can't do this, you can't do that, you need to go to school.
Yeah.
There's none of that. So the theatrical agent is probably like, okay, this kid looks
brilliant.
Pretty
Here's
independent.
Here's a feral kid.
Yeah.
There's
do what we want,
no
don't
strings.
Have to pay him too much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And his brother also is going with him to the agents and trying to find acting as well, isn't he?
I think so. They had the same plan. They both had the plan to make it as actors.
But Charlie got took on very quickly. And you know it, he's on tour.
He's on tour earning a decent wage. I guess saying your name's Charles Chaplin as well, they probably said, oh, are you son of Charles Chaplin?
Oh, Charles Chaplin Sr. Yeah.
And he probably said, and they're probably like, oh, he's going to be great.
Yeah. And the thing with these plays is he's working with seasoned actors and he's obviously still a teenager. The plays aren't necessarily well received, but the reviews already start to mention Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, they single him
out. And how brilliant he is. And that actually gets up the nose of the older actors.
Yeah.
They're being upstaged by this fantastic young talent.
Yeah.
So his talent is being recognised almost immediately.
And he's on £2.10 a week, which is a fortune to him at that point. And then he's on a 40-week tour, and then he manages to get his brother Sydney a small part.
Right, okay.
So then, because of the first tour, he sounded very lonely. He's only a kid. They were united on tour, and it bonded them, brother and Charlie
and Sydney.
Like, for the rest of their lives, they were really close, and it's a really nice friendship, isn't it? They're really good to each other.
And Charlie is quite quickly getting rave reviews. His talent is being noticed and he's getting really good constant employment in theatre, isn't he?
Yeah, it's amazing. And his pay keeps going up. He had a spate when he was back in London. He was spending all his money. And it says on things like prostitutes and pool halls. And he's obviously living it up. And that was what you did with money then.
And then this time, so he's being successful as part of a touring company. Doesn't he try to break out on his own as a comedian?
Yeah.
Is that happening now?
And really fails.
Oh, my God. And it goes terribly.
Yeah.
Where to the point that the family he's lodging with has a young daughter and she comes to see him. And the audience just turn and they start booing and throwing stuff. And to the point where the young daughter and the family just avoids him from then on because she doesn't want to see him.
So embarrassing.
It was so bad.
That's bad.
Interesting, though, that his first solo outing just completely fails.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And then he gets a really good job at some point as a lead. Oh, yeah, because he'd been the comedy stooge for this big star.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it says that he was hilarious and got the audience really laughing in a way that the previous person in that job hadn't.
Right.
So he made everybody love the whole show better. Mm-hmm. And he also made the star look good. So yes. He wasn't trying to steal it. Yes. He was actually doing elevating it just right. It. He's so good at his job.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's really cool. And then eventually he got the star part when the star left and lost his voice.
Oh, man.
He was ill. He lost his voice a week in and it was really, and they were really mad at him.
And nobody could hear
messing
him.
Messing it up.
Yeah.
So he thought that was it for a while.
Yeah.
But then he persisted and he really said to this bloke, look, you've got to give me a job. I can do it. I can do it. And he got on a job that was touring to America, which was his dream. He wanted to go and he got it and off they went. And what was it? Oh, it was with Kano.
Kano.
Yeah.
Yeah, the massively famous company.
Yeah, which is kind of like, it's like reading about Andrew Lloyd Webber or somebody who's a big producer in the West End now, because this bloke had all these shows out there on the road. He had a big warehouse where he stored 20 sets from different shows. Mm-hmm. So it's just like any modern theatre producer now.
Yeah. It's like a massive operation.
Yeah, massive operation.
It was a company to work for if you wanted to go to America. Yeah. And obviously he had spotted Charlie Chaplin's immense talent.
Yeah.
And thought, I need this guy.
Yeah.
And he got him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And off they went. And I love it when he gets to America because the descriptions, again, you've got a chance to read about 1900s.
Yeah.
New York, how it looked, how it was, you know, suddenly see these high rises. And there's not half of them that there is now at all, but just walking the streets and absorbing it and Broadway and how amazing it was and all the connections between Britain and America.
Yeah.
It's great. So he's really seen America. He's touring for a few years, actually, just touring in these shows all across America and back.
And then he is scouted because his shows are popular and, you know, people are hearing about this fantastic English comedian that everybody has to go and see. And then the film industry obviously is blossoming and he's scouted by the Keystone Studios, who are incredibly popular with the Keystone Cops, etc. Yeah. And they love his brand of, do we call it slapstick or does that demean it a bit?
Yeah, let's call it that.
It's physical comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they want him in their films.
Mm. He gets a nice contract. He's going to get paid £150 a week for a year.
Oh, hang on. I'm remembering now. He's brought in to replace an older actor.
Right.
And then when he gets there, the directors are a bit perturbed about how young he looks. Because not only, I think he's something early 20s, but he looks younger than that. And they thought they were getting an older character actor.
Because he always plays older characters when he's
in these
shows.
Yeah, everybody's, even the women that he like chats to are always surprised after the show that he's a lot younger than what they thought.
Yeah.
So they don't use him straight away at the Keystone Studios. He's just like, they'll say, okay, kids, stand over there. And but when they're not using him, he stands and he watches and he absorbs and he watches a director at work and the actors.
And people like Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah.
Legendary people and all these Keystone Cops that he's seen in films and he's seen them with his own eyes.
And there's a lot going on. It's not just like one film set, like in a studio, there'll be like three films all being filmed. I kind of thought, what about the noise? And I kind of thought, well, they're silent movies.
Exactly.
It doesn't actually matter.
I went through the same thought process. Another thing that blew my mind is that they make all these films in California. Because the sunshine, because they didn't have lighting.
Yeah.
So they had to do them in the daytime with natural light. So they have to film them where there's the most light.
Most light.
And that's why Hollywood's in California.
Because of the sun.
Yes. They didn't even use lamps then. They just didn't use them.
And they used to make them so quickly.
Oh, my God. Knocking like out one film a week.
Straight onto the next one.
It's
I guess if you don't have to worry about things like sound. And so if you would just film it, quick as you can, splice it all together.
I had no idea they knocked out these films so fast. And also, when he turned up, they said, oh, there's no scripts, there's no story. We just get this vague, we get an idea, and then we run with it.
Yeah.
Which suited him so well because his head was full of ideas.
And I love the birth of the iconic tramp image. Because so he's been hanging around not being used, and then at one point the director just says to him, okay, come on then, and he just says just dress up as something,
go and get into a costume.
And he's like, well, what anything. And it's just like, well, if he'd given me just maybe like a postman or a soldier, I had something to wear with. Nothing.
He goes, he finds these baggy trousers, oversized boots, a really tight jacket, yeah, so it looks too small.
And a hat.
So, yeah, hat. And he puts on a moustache to make him look older, but he trims it to make sure you can see his mouth.
Still see his face and his mannerisms.
That's how he invented Charlie Chaplin.
It was just completely off the cuff.
And a cane to look older again.
Yeah. It's incredible that that came together with somebody just saying, we need you, just go and dress up as anything.
And he was really nervous because he wasn't sure what input he could give. But as soon as he put this outfit together, he he found a character.
Yeah, he became the character.
And it was a great one.
Yeah.
And so he stuck with it.
And that became a defining, along with Marilyn Monroe's skirt blowing up.
Yeah.
That and Charlie Chaplin, I would say, are the two defining images of the history of cinema.
Yes.
And he literally picked all that stuff up in a minute.
You don't need a costume designer.
And,
amazing, though.
Yeah, it is amazing.
And I love the description. It says the first thing he did, he went on the set and he tripped over a person's foot and said sorry. And then he tripped over a lampshade and said sorry to the lampshade. That's the first thing he did. And everyone fell about laughing.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, this is great. So then he was just used.
Yeah, it's just completely, like you say, they have an outline of a script and basically say to him, go on then, make us laugh or whatever.
Yeah.
And he just
does
it.
He knows how to, But it sounds like in no time he started going, I've got more ideas.
Yeah.
Because the director wasn't happy. It's sort of the power he was wielding.
Yeah.
And then they gave him to this female director.
Yes, Mabel Normand.
Yeah, and he had trouble with that. But there's a scene, they were outside, and they said, we just want you to shoot water through a fire hose. And he said, but wouldn't it be funnier if I stood on it and looked and there was no water? And then I took my foot off and I got water in my face. Yeah. Oh, I haven't got time. We haven't got time for that. We've just got to get this done. Well, you read that, you go, of course that's funnier. Just let him do it.
Yeah.
So they sort of had power struggle. And then he said to the boss, look, can I direct one? I've got 15 grand saved. I will put the money in. If you don't trust me, if this makes the money back, give me my 15 grand back. And if it doesn't, you can keep it. And that's how much I believe I can do this. So they let him direct one and then he's off.
Yeah.
Because he's writing, directing, acting.
Well, he's producing. He's putting his own money up.
Yeah.
In the beginning, he was this fantastic talent. And it's almost like the directors and stuff still wanted their control. So they were happy for him to do stuff within the scene. But the minute he started saying, oh, this would be good, that would be good.
Yeah,
like, don't get
it
above yourself.
Yes. Because he had so much knowledge of theatre that they didn't actually have.
Yeah.
They'd been around films a lot.
Yeah.
They had an idea, but he really knew about theatre.
So that we say all that happened, but that happened actually relatively quite quickly because they're making the film so fast. It sounds like he was in 14 films before they let him have any type of control, but they did 14 films in 14 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's like within a year.
It's really quick.
Let's just say within a year, he is directing and producing and acting in films.
And the other part of them running with it, by the way, which I really like, is they'd say things like, oh, yeah, there's a leak on Main Street, so let's run and make a funny film about there being water all over the Main Street. So you've really got to think on your feet, haven't you?
Yeah, right, yeah.
They'd probably make that whole film in a day before the water goes. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's improv.
Yeah, and it totally is. God, that would never happen now.
No.
It would take a day to set the lights up.
No. It's so interesting, isn't it?
So he's doing all of these films for the Keystone Studios and his contract expires, right? And then he says something like, oh, I want £1,000 a week now, which is a big jump, but he's earning it.
Yeah.
And
he's making it for them.
They say no.
Yeah.
So then it's the S&A Studios who say, we'll give you £1,250 a week and a £10,000 introduction bonus or something, which Charlie Chaplin hadn't even thought about asking for. So that was a done deal.
Yeah.
He moved from Keystone to S&A Studios.
He was really taking off and there was a massive demand both sides of the pond for his films and they were selling out.
And it's S&A who actually give him his own studio to work in, right?
Yeah.
So he's really making it at this point.
Yeah, he's getting big.
And he's also at S&A, he's got his studio and he's getting his stock company of actors together, like Edna Purviance, who becomes his leading lady.
He was just a girl in a cafe who was beautiful.
A pretty girl. One thing about this autobiography, every single woman he talks about, oh, she's very pretty, oh, she's very attractive, she's so good looking.
Yeah.
It's just like every single woman is
It's true. It says Chaplin mania is kicking off around that time as well.
Right.
Like dolls and cigarettes and books and toothpaste. He was on everything. thing. Yeah. I didn't know there was that mania about him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that he commanded streets to have to be shut because people found out he was coming. And mm-hmm. Well, I guess he was the first film star, probably.
I think the image of the tramp really helped, though, because that's so easily reproduced.
Recognizable, yeah.
Yeah, that I think that really just cemented the fact, like it was that persona of him that went massive.
That's true.
And so people could immediately identify him.
Yeah.
So it can be put on any kind of product whatsoever.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it really, I'm amazed that that just came from him scrambling about and putting a character together at the last
minute.
It's
so casual.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not around this time he was in LA, obviously, and he wanted to go to New York and see his brother and have a little break.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent a telegram. I'm on this train. I will reach you by this time. But you have to phone a receptionist to have the telegram put through, don't you? Mm-hmm. So you have to verbally tell someone.
Yep.
She obviously told other people and it kind of went viral in its own
way, word of
mouth. So every single stop on his train, which is a long journey right across America in those days. It's a real around the world in 8 days journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you sometimes have to stop and stay the night somewhere and stuff. Everywhere he went was mobbed. He was mobbed. Because to them, he was a fictional character. How can he be coming to your town? He's from the films.
Mm-hmm.
How can someone step from a screen off a train? You know, you'd be like that. I've got to see for myself with my eyes. Like,
and also, it's such an early stage of cinema.
Exactly.
It's still new to everyone.
And magical.
Yeah.
Really magical.
Like a real, like one of the first cultural phenomenons, I guess. It's almost like Jesus coming through on the train. Everyone wants to go and see him.
Yeah.
I bet that was so exciting.
Yeah.
I bet even if you were just a kid or anyone in a town and the train was passing through, I'd go and see him, even if it just went the train shot past.
Yeah. It's partly to do with comprehending the magic of film, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is to do with that. But also everyone loved him.
Yeah.
And he'd realised when he started making his own films, they were all slapstick. But then when he started doing it, he realised that he could move people to laughter and tears.
Yeah.
So he actually was adding more
pathos,
realistic life lessons.
And he would, when he does get his own studio with S&A and he's got his own company of actors and stuff, he is taking more time to make his films.
Yeah.
He's not bashing one out in a week. He's really thinking about it, really thinking about the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's working.
So they're getting better and better and they're really connecting with people
he's
more
really
and more.
Reeling people in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by the time he gets to New York, the whole of Grand Central Station and the streets have to be closed, I think, isn't it? It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah. It's incredible to think that little kid who, like, literally just a decade before was living in poverty. I mean, how this is, like, it's around 1915 where he becomes this massive cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
So what, he was born in 1889, 15, so he's 26.
Yeah.
And when he was 16, he was just getting his first acting job. And now he's
so
world
much has happened to him.
Famous.
I'll write this quote down. I always thought I would like the public's attention, and here it was, paradoxically isolating me with a depressing sense of loneliness.
Ah, oh, damn. That's fame.
It's a common story, isn't it? But, it's strange. Yeah. Till, of course, what happened was he found that he could go into society and find a whole bunch of really amazing friends and acquaintances, which he didn't always want to be social, but when he did, the pick of the people he could hang out with was fascinating, and fascinating to him.
Yeah, of course, because one thing that happens when the whole world wants to know you, when people are flocking to train stations to catch a glimpse of you, well, then, of course, New York high society want you around for supper and tea. So he's meeting everyone, isn't he?
Yeah, which is, he's obviously enjoying that.
Yeah.
He writes a lot about various legends.
Yeah.
Sarah Bernhardt Nijinsky.
Well, Nijinsky loved him because he actually said that Charlie Chaplin's physical comedy was like ballet.
Yeah,
I loved that, actually.
Yeah,
that
really
Nijinsky
cool.
can actually, like, obviously Charlie Chaplin is a cut above. That's why he has succeeded and become the most famous person on earth.
Yeah.
But somebody who knows about art and movement and dance can actually spot the quality of what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool, isn't it? And Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, who is a legendary actor.
What's his name?
I'm not saying that again.
Go on. For the listeners at home.
No. But he was a legendary actor of his day, like your Olivier or whatever, and who he'd idolised. But he got to meet his heroes.
Yeah.
And Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
Yes.
And Mary Pickford became his best friends. And that was a really great friendship, wasn't it? Three of them. Yeah, lasting.
There would have been so few people at that point who would have known true international fame, actually. So I'm not surprising that they actually formed a little club.
Yeah.
Because who else would have been able to relate to them?
Yeah, exactly.
So his fame is just, he's the biggest thing in the world now, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then his contract comes up with SNA. And of course, everybody wants him. So everybody's making offers.
Yeah.
And I forget who he goes with now. It's Mutual Film or...
First National,
that's it.
And Sydney had struck the deal with them to make 8 two-reel comedies for $1,200,000. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, and it says, at 26 years old, Charlie Chaplin is one of the highest paid people in the world. Not just the highest paid actor, one of the highest paid people.
It's amazing.
It's incredible.
But that's how many people are flocking to see his films.
And that's a kid who had nothing, poverty.
Yeah.
And now he's one of the highest paid people in the world.
It's amazing. Then he'd done that deal, right, to make the films, but they didn't have their own studio. So he bought land and he made his own studio. So he had control. Oh, this is really exciting because there was around that time he was talking to Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and they're saying, and some other friends, nobody's renewing their contracts. Something must be going on. This is genius. They hire a detective who is an attractive woman. She accidentally bumped into the head of some studios in the hotel and said, "Don't I know you from somewhere?" And then started going out with each other. And he just told her everything. Yeah, all the big studios were going to come together and form a merger so they'd have more power over the actors. So they wouldn't be fighting to pay them higher wages and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Charlie Chaplin go, right, we're going to form our own company called United Artists.
I didn't know this.
Nor did I.
I know.
That's who formed that company, which still goes today.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And so they had this dinner in a really, the place where all the film people are always hanging out. And everyone's going, why are those three together? And then they announced at the end of that dinner, it was the night before the merger was going to be announced, that they were forming this company. And they're the biggest stars and they're the biggest draw. So it takes them out of the picture. So then other film producers and stuff went, we're jumping in with you then.
Mm-hmm.
And it just ruined the plans.
Yeah.
So they couldn't have power over the artist as
Amazing.
Much. Brilliant.
That was a real, when I was reading that, I was like, wow, that came from those
three. Know. So he's one of those amazing people that's brilliant, a brilliant artist, a brilliant ideas man, and good at business as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's excellent.
Yeah.
He really has it all. And he's good looking.
I know, he's a good looking. And actually, I think the tramp is actually quite good looking anyway, in
so
a certain
I.
way.
Yeah.
Obviously, because he had to be this massive phenomenon.
Yeah.
He's a good looking, cute tramp.
Yeah.
But then take that off, and he's a good looking
man.
Yeah, he could have been like a matinee idol looking like
yes,
he looked.
He could have.
Easily. So this is all happening around the time of the First World War. And Charlie Chaplin is not fighting
in
the First War. And he come under a lot of flack for that.
Came under attack for that.
He did come under attack. But then he reasoned, I fully understand this, he said it's more important for me being this successful comedy
people.
That can keep people going through the war. That job was as important as any during the First World
Entertaining
War.
Entertaining the troops.
Yeah. He also begins to become a bit vocal about the war. And, you know, he raises money for the Liberty Bonds.
Yeah.
And he does a campaign and he puts his face on it, which is raising money for the Allies of the First World War.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where politics, they don't seep into the work as such. But he does make a short film that helps to raise funds for the bonds. The next film he makes as a tramp was in the trenches of the First World War. So that's kind of like a little precursor to what comes later. He's not overtly political in his work yet, but as a person
he's getting involved and he's making speeches as himself, not as a character.
Yeah.
And he's getting good at it.
Yeah.
He's good at it. Yeah. He really sells a lot of bonds.
Yeah. So it's good that he didn't go and get killed.
It really is. It really is. Yeah. Yeah. So almost as a side note, he got married because he brushes over some of this because we don't need to know.
Well, look, we don't need to know, but one of the criticisms Charlie Chaplin does come in for, historically speaking, his penchant for young ladies.
Very young.
And they are all young. He's like late 20s, and Mildred is the first wife, right?
Yeah.
She's 16. She said she's pregnant. That's why he marries her. And it turns out she isn't. So is she lying to him or what? I mean, he's obviously having sex with a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And I guess back then if she says she's pregnant, shit, you've got to marry her.
Yeah. Was that the one he married in Mexico because it was illegal to marry a 16-year-old?
No, that's the next 16-year-old.
Okay. Shall we just leap to that as well then?
Yeah, but no, the marriage to Mildred doesn't last because he's just... They're not meant to be together.
Well, it says 2 days after they got married, she signed a deal with Louis B. Mayer.
Oh, to be in...
To be in the films with a different company. He said, don't sign with him. Sign with me. I'll put you in films. Then we can work together. She said, no, I'm going to sign with this opposing company.
So that's, you think this 16-year-old girl saw having sex with Charlie Chaplin as a career move?
Oh, I never said that.
No, but I mean, it looks like it, doesn't it?
Does give you that impression, to be
honest. I mean, it's just that thing where you're a successful... He's the most successful man in the world. He could have as many 16-year-olds as he wanted, it turns out.
Well, that's
he does
true,
want them.
And it's a bit of a shame she did that, because who knows what would have happened if she'd have just stuck with him.
It's looking at all this through today's lens about a successful man in the film industry having numerous relationships with teenage women. Mm. I don't think that anybody would stand for it these days. And I think a lot of the criticism Charlie Chaplin comes in for retrospectively, this is like the main thing that people criticize him for. And, you know, okay, he's still relatively young at this point, but he's getting older and older.
He gets older and they stay the same age.
Women stay the same age.
That's very true.
But nothing's... Oh, no, I was just about to say nothing's illegal, but actually it is, because he has to take one of them to Mexico to get married.
Yeah.
And that is Lita
she
Gray.
Was 15?
No, she was 16,
she
but
was
the,
16.
The ages of getting married in the America vary from state to state.
Okay.
And actually, if he's taking her to Mexico, it possibly sounds like the whole of America back then was probably 18.
Right.
Unless Mexico was nearer than a state you had to get.
Yeah.
Get married at 16. Yeah. But another thing with Lita Gray, she'd been in
some
of his
wife?
Films. The second wife, sorry. Lita Gray is the second wife. She'd been in some of his films. He's known her since she was a child. And she gets pregnant at 16 by him.
Yeah.
So, and he's 35 at this point. So it's so, I mean,
I know.
It's not great, is it? But even if she was just a couple years old, but the fact he knew her as a child and she's pregnant at 16, it's pretty grim. Look, I'm going to separate it from him and gushing about his genius and his cinematic
These are
achievements.
Just the facts.
But he's a bit of a dog of a man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Which, again, I really struggle with, because some of the things he goes on to do politically are bloody fantastic.
Oh, I know. We've got to tell it like it is. This is part of it.
Yeah. And he's a complicated person. So we can sit here and say we love his achievements, we love his art, but actually the fact that he has a succession of 16-year-old brides, I find that pretty grim, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's us skipping forward, because in the meantime, right, in the middle of his first marriage going pear-shaped after she signs to the enemy, he sees this boy of four called Jackie Coogan in a play. He's stuck for an idea at that point. He can't think. He's got no inspiration. And he goes, this kid is fantastic. I need to get that kid and I can put a whole film around the tramp and the kid, which is like his best film to date, it turns out to be.
Oh, it just...
It's genius because the kid was brilliant.
Yes.
Anyway, so that happened at that time. Plus his mother... flew over and they housed her in a bungalow by the sea, and he got a staff.
Mm-hmm.
She ended her days in California sunshine.
How nice.
She's good.
That he could do that for
her. It's really good. And he said, she'd kept me and Sydney off the streets and made us feel we were not the ordinary product of poverty, but unique and distinguished. That's amazing,
so
isn't it?
Yeah,
growing up in workhouses, and that's how she made them feel.
Yeah.
And that's how he got to be him. Partly.
No, that's great. And and because of that, she could end her days in the sunny California rather than in the workhouse.
Yeah.
So it paid off.
Yeah.
Good.
And then around this time, then he decides to go back to London, and he hasn't been back to Britain for 10 years and finds himself like royalty, like a royal reception.
Yeah.
Invited to Buckingham Palace, invited everywhere. Crowds around his hotel even. That's when he gets the cab and revisits his youth.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. And he actually takes a bit of time to enjoy his life and visit people. So then, anyway, he's back from London. Well, he finally is free of his other contract so he can start making films for United Artists, and that's right. when he can make all the profit. And he made The Gold Rush at that point.
Yeah, and he actually thinks at that moment in time that's the best film he's ever made. This is 1925, and it becomes one of the highest grossing films of the silent era.
All time.
With a US box office of $5 million, which is astounding. That's probably like a billion these
Incredible.
Days, right?
Yeah.
So look, this he's just created one of the biggest films of all time in 1925.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's when this is when he married Lita Gray.
And he says, I don't want to talk about Lita Gray or our time together, because out of that came two sons, Charlie and Sidney.
Charlie and Sidney, yeah.
And they're obviously fantastic sons that he completely loves, and he doesn't mm-hmm. want to talk about it, but that's a good thing. Yeah, my God, the crazy trip to Japan.
So he takes time off to go travelling, right?
Yeah.
Where this blows my mind.
It's very strange.
And so he kind of, he's due a meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister, but the night before he goes out for a drink or a meal with the Prime Minister's son, right? While they're in this private room having a meal with the Japanese Prime Minister's son, these guys burst in. I forget. Do you remember exactly what happened?
There's six blokes and they're really threatening them.
Yeah.
And so Charlie Chaplin stands up and like pretends that he's got a gun under his jacket.
He's got a gun under his jacket.
Says back off, and he hasn't got a gun.
No.
Back up.
But he's very good with stagecraft.
He's good at acting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they all back off and they go back to the hotel and find they've been ransacked. They've been searched. The room's been searched. So he's already getting a bit worried about this.
Yeah, and then the next day he was due to go and see the Japanese Prime Minister, but
The son takes them to a wrestling match.
Right, yes. And while they're at the wrestling match, the Japanese Prime Minister is assassinated. In his own home, where Charlie Chaplin should have been. By this group of men who came in.
Yep, they were going to assassinate Charlie Chaplin, probably that night in the restaurant, in fact.
Of course, they came in, yeah.
Then they bottled it and they decided, just like terrorists do, you kill the most famous man in the world to prove your power.
Yeah.
And then they bottled it because they thought it might provoke a war with America.
Right.
It might bring in America to fight against them.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not even American. They obviously, like you,
well, see,
didn't
I
know
thought
he was British. Yeah.
I would have done that. I'd have killed Charlie Chaplin to get America's attention. And they're like, damn, he's actually British. But that's mad to think that he was close to being assassinated.
Yeah, because of just his importance.
Wow.
Yeah. And also to be with the bloke's son.
Yeah.
When he found out his dad had just been killed. It was absolutely dreadful.
Puts a bit of a downer on your trip to Japan, doesn't it?
Oh, it's shocking. Yeah. It's terrifying. So he's quite happy to finish his holiday at that point. And they get back to the US.
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt's now president.
Yeah.
Trying to turn depression around.
Mm-hmm.
Paulette Goddard, he meets, a beautiful actress.
Okay. And this is backing the trend because she's positively ancient at the age of 21.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
She sounds like they really get on and they have a good laugh. And she's a nice, interesting, cool person.
Yeah, for sure. He is, let's put this into perspective, he's 43, 44 at this point. She's 21, so he's still twice her age.
Yeah, right.
But she ain't a teenager.
No.
So.
Yeah. She's a feisty character, by all accounts. They make Modern Times together, which is depression-themed.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, he took her and her mum to China. It's kind of on a whim because I think they're heading for Hawaii and he's like, let's just carry on. They decide to get married and I think that's a happier one, isn't it, that one?
Yeah, for sure. So Modern Times is a film where he starts playing again with political imagery and messages within his filmmaking, right? So the older he gets, he's kind of becoming, he's always been socially conscious, but I guess, you know, at the age of 45 or whatever, when you've done oodles of slapstick comedy films. As an artist, he's developing. He wants to do something a bit more worthy rather than just entertainment. And his political stuff is coming to the forefront more and more.
Which you can't ignore it. If you're in the middle of, you've just come through a war and it's depression, you can't, could ignore it, but he evolves.
Soon after then, don't we get The Great Dictator?
We do get The Great Dictator. It's very interesting because you get the sort of build-up to the Second World War, don't you?
Yeah, and Chaplin, he's kind of was watching what's happening through the 30s and the rise of nationalism. Mm. And I guess even what happened in Japan, that was a product of nationalism, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Almost being assassinated.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he's watching that. So it's all going in and it's coming, beginning to come out in his art. And then there's this guy called Hitler.
Hitler.
there's some similarities between Charlie Chaplin and Hitler, not least the moustache.
It's the main thing, yeah. But also, around that time, he was really struggling with working out how to evolve from silent films, because talkies.
Oh, we haven't talked about talkies, of course.
And he got quite depressed because he thought that his time was over.
Yeah.
And people saying, you have to make speaking films.
Yeah.
And he didn't know how to take that character and give it a voice.
Yeah.
And felt he couldn't, which I think he's right. He couldn't, really. Yeah. And so when he hit upon this idea, if he did a film about Hitler, he could also play Hitler and make a mockery out of him, or he could have his tramp character still be silent within that film and play both parts, which is brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic idea.
And it's obviously hilarious, plus adding this big anti-war speech at the end.
Now, this is the thing that kind of almost triggers his downfall in popularity. Public favour had been swaying a bit, and him being quite vocal about fascism and stuff. That didn't always seep into his films, but now he's done The Great Dictator.
Yeah.
And he chooses to end it with a 5-minute speech against war and fascism.
Yeah.
So there's no
grey area here. Which side of the fence he's sat on.
I really tried to think, it's somebody who's so universal and appeals to everyone.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, you're doing something which is alienating half of your audience.
Yeah.
And I tried to think about it. Good on him, but it's such a risk. I tried to think of it in modern terms. And
who would do that?
I'm thinking Dolly Parton is loved by everyone.
She never
gets political, ever. And so I would imagine at that time, it would be like going to a Dolly Parton concert and the last 5 minutes, so it's being beamed to the world, and the last 5 minutes she did like an anti-Trump speech or something.
Yeah.
Half of her audience is gone.
Yep.
And that's exactly what Charlie Chaplin has done with The Great Dictator.
Yeah, that's right. He's chosen a team.
Yeah.
At that point. And it's really fascinating because he actually describes, if you go around New York around that time, during the Second World War, there's actual Nazis speaking on pedestals in the street.
Right,
and he said they were all out, as equal as the lefties and the righties. They were all out debating throughout the war, right up until the Holocaust became public.
Right.
And then they went underground.
Right.
They disappeared. Mm-hmm. And it's just that thing where, wow, of course they're still out there now today, because they only went quiet. They didn't go away.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know. It's nuts, isn't it?
It's really
interesting. You never hear about that. Oh, I don't.
Yeah.
Like the reality of walking around the streets of New York during the war. Because, of course, they weren't involved until much later, the Americans either.
Yeah, no, they weren't. In fact, they weren't even affected by the first couple of years of the war. They weren't rationed or anything. And then eventually they got brought in.
Yeah.
But that speech at the end of The Great Dictator, like Winston Churchill and Roosevelt, they liked it. And they would. Roosevelt invited Chaplin to read the speech over the radio during the inauguration.
Mm.
So it wasn't just reaching the people who saw that film in the cinema.
Mm.
That actual political speech was getting a worldwide.
Yeah.
Probably not a single American or English person who didn't hear it. Actually, Chaplin's anti-fascist
speech. This is where my conspiracy theory comes in.
Yeah.
Because as soon as somebody gets that powerful and actually becomes political,
I'm with you, go on.
They take them down.
Yes.
And this completely seemingly crazy woman who started
Barry.
To stalk him.
Yes.
I think he had a very brief thing with her, and then immediately he went, she's nuts, and stopped it. She didn't let it go. She stalked him. She made sure the police were called.
Yeah.
Then the publicity came with that. And then she said she was pregnant and took him to court. And it was all really, really public. He had a paternity test that said he absolutely couldn't be the father of that child. And it still went to court.
Yeah.
And he still lost in court. Yeah. And they made him pay paternity till she was 21. That has to be the government.
Yeah.
Or some, not necessarily the government, but the powers.
Yeah.
Trying to take him down.
Yeah.
Which ultimately led to him being banned from America.
Yeah.
He just got too powerful.
I think they even tried to bring like 4 charges against him, but only one of them stuck, which was this archaic law about taking somebody over state lines and impregnating them, which it was just a ridiculous thing. But it was the only thing they could get on him.
Yeah.
And they did everything to make sure that stuck.
Yeah.
And even to the point, like you say, he wasn't the father of that child.
Yeah, no,
but that seemed
didn't
to get
count for anything.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So then I thought, well, okay, he is still a person who liked younger women, but the publicity he got was for something he didn't do, and they destroyed him.
It's kind of like, all right, they went for him and they found something which they could make it, at least the public and the powers that be believe happen.
Yeah.
It's almost like that Michael Jackson thing. He spent much too much time with young boys.
Yeah, you go for their weak link.
Yeah.
And they've always got a weak link.
Yeah, of course.
So that was his.
Yeah.
And they went for it.
And you can, and there's nothing.
Easy to get them on.
There's nothing that can turn the public against you faster than saying, oh, you're having sex with underage people.
Yeah, or you're fathering illegitimate people and denying it. He absolutely didn't do that.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't matter that he didn't do it. They got him on it.
They got him on it.
They turned, half his audience were against him anyway.
Yes,
because
they
of
were.
This speech.
Yes, they were.
And now they absolutely use that, the FBI, the government, the American government, because he was too powerful.
That's right.
He'd done this speech and they wanted to ruin him and finish him. And they didn't. Ultimately, it ended up with him having to leave.
Well, he did. When he went to Britain just to visit, they wouldn't renew his visa. And they said, when you come back, if you come back to the US, you'll have to go before a board of inquiry for political and moral reasons. So he never went back.
But luckily,
exiled. Actually, exiled.
What we've glossed over quick, because this is quite important. He, at the age of 54, he married another 18-year-old Una. They stayed together till he died, and they had 8 children together.
Yeah,
I mean, I still struggle with her being 18 and him being 54.
Yeah,
but
I think she was older than her years in a way, because
that's what they all say.
But she was the daughter of Eugene O'Neill, great playwright. Yeah, she's completely grown up in the similar world that he did, in the same way that he was a lot older than 18 when he was 18.
But the lucky thing about having Una is that just before they left America, he thought he wouldn't be allowed back in.
Yeah.
So they put her name on everything.
Yeah.
Because they thought the American government were going to seize all of his money, all of his possessions, all of his property. And so they made sure they signed it over to Una before they left. Yeah. And she had to go back on her own to get it all.
Go to the bank vaults to retrieve their fortune.
And there was a moment where she thought they weren't going to even give it to her.
Yeah.
But they did. So that was lucky they sorted that out. Yeah, 10 minutes before
Oh my God. Yeah, he just got to the bank just before it closed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is, you agree with me then. It's pure conspiracy, isn't it?
Because
he got so powerful.
Do you know what? What have we read so far? Jane Fonda and Michael Jackson to a certain extent. And now Charlie Chaplin, almost Morrissey to a certain extent. When you're anti-establishment.
Yes.
And you get a certain level of fame and exposure. So people are listening to you.
I'll throw that in there.
They will bring you down.
They'll take you down.
They will bring you down.
Yeah.
And you know what?
Because you've got power.
Yeah. And we are reading these books now for years to come. This is going to be a running theme.
It is.
I already know it.
It is.
Big. Your audience gets too big and you're saying something which the government do not want you to promote. Yeah. They will end it.
Yeah. It's nuts. I know. There's probably loads of people out there who absolutely knew this, but I didn't know.
Yeah. I didn't know any of it.
Yeah.
I just knew that he was dressed as a tramp.
So, I mean, from that point on, they just have, he makes the odd film, more talkies, and he plays other characters, and he makes a romance, and he makes a serial killer film, and he takes his time doing it, and they retire to Switzerland, have 8 children.
8 children.
And who all became really interesting people, because I've seen his grandchildren.
Oh, yeah, well, one of his granddaughters is called Una, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a great actress.
And they're sort of French, Swiss people. And they do, but it's not acting. I've seen them do sort of it's amazing. It's part acrobatic, it's part surrealist theatre.
Oh, so the vaudeville element is still there.
Yes.
Wow.
And it's absolutely amazing, and that's his grandchildren out there doing that.
So that came from his parents.
Yeah.
You know, all right, Charlie Chaplin became one of the most famous actors in the world, but actually from his mum and his dad, the vaudeville aspect has carried right through him, right to his grandchildren.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Tradition.
And now the house they lived in has become a museum to him in Switzerland.
Has it?
Yeah, only in the last few years.
So we should just say at this point that Charlie Chaplin's autobiography is an immense, dense tome.
Fascinating.
He's a really good storyteller. Sometimes he's breaking down what happens in his silent films. It's like you get little stories in those, and they sound great.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the history of poor London.
Yes.
It's the history of vaudeville and music hall.
Yes.
And the beginning of film.
Film, yeah.
And actually the evolution of film into talkies and film as we know it today.
Yeah.
That's all in one person's lifetime.
Yeah. But also the political side with the wars and the speeches and meetings. Do you know what? Again, he's meeting Gandhi, Churchill. There's so much in this book. It's a lot. Well, it took him 5 years
so
to write.
Much.
Like Jane Fonda's took her 5 years to write, and Charlie Chaplin took 5 years. And I think there's a lot of comparisons between these two autobiographies.
If you've led a full life, it should take you a long time to write your book out. Yeah. Something's wrong.
Yeah. So, listeners, go get yourself the Charlie Chaplin autobiography because it's a real experience. Yeah. I learned so much. And again, everybody else we've read so far has been like modern celebrity. So it's just really actually quite refreshing to read one that begins in Dickensian London.
Yeah. And there's hundreds of anecdotes we haven't even mentioned.
Oh, there
hundreds.
We've missed out
characters
loads.
And,
we've talked for like an hour. We've scratched the surface. Honestly, treat yourself and get Charlie Chaplin's autobiography.
I agree.
If you don't mind a man marrying 16-year-old girls. Don't laugh at
no,
that.
No, don't say it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thrift Shop Biography. We love making this podcast and we're absolutely thrilled that so many of you are already listening. We're new to this and you could really help us out by leaving us a review somewhere, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you could share us, tell your friends about us or drop some links on social media. We have a Facebook page called Thrift Shop Biography. So make sure you come over there to hear about the episodes first and what else we're up to. Okay, see you next week. And if you're new here, there are loads more episodes now to go and listen in the back catalogue, so make sure you go and enjoy them. Okay, thank you very much.